Warning! Today's story contains violence, profane language, and disturbing themes. Halloween runs a bit long this year.
Escape Pod 183. November 9th, 2008. Today's story, Beans and Myrtles, by Floris M. Kleiner.
Hello and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. I felt a bit bad about running our Halloween story last week a couple of days late. To make up for it, here's another science fiction horror story, this one considerably more modern. We present Beans and Marbles by Floris M. Kleiner. Mr. Kleiner lives in Amsterdam, where he works in software training and ISO certification, which is its own brand of horror, and he won first place in the Writers of the Future contest in 2005. This story first appeared in Andromeda Spaceway's In-Flight magazine in August of 2005. So brew yourself another pot of coffee. You're not going to want to go to sleep. It's story time. Beans and Marbles by Floris M. Kleiner. When Flight Control assigned us utility privileges, I don't think they expected me to brew espresso in the centrifugal head. But the weight of the espresso machine was well within the parameters they'd set, as was my use of a couple of ounces of fresh water and a fraction of the ship's power supply each day. So there was nothing, really, they could say or do about it. Privileges are privileges, and if the purpose was to give both of us something to keep us happy, it worked for me. My morning espresso ritual kept me sane. I looked forward to it every day. Richard, however, wasn't quite as tolerant as Flight Control. I finished the morning systems check and shoved myself away from the instrument panel with a practiced one-handed gesture. I had done this hundreds of times before, so often, in fact, that there was a black smudge visible on the edge of the panel, a spot of the same sticky dirt and grease mixture that coated the curved back of my father's computer mouse back home. Yeah, but let's not think about home, shall we? The shove propelled me up into the empty spherical volume of the control room and sent me spinning along my axis. A measured push stopped me, and I ended up facing the storage cabinets against the bulkhead, where we kept the supplies we needed while on duty. In the pocket-sized fridge, I found only one squeeze bottle of drinking water, and I made a mental note to resupply later that day. Taking the bottle and closing the fridge, I moved to my personal cabinet and got out a measured portion of my traveling treasure. Ah, those beans. There is an art to buying coffee. And I knew I was an artist. I believe I spent weeks before departure selecting just the right blend of Brazilian Bourbon Santos beans and mocha beans imported from South Yemen. My coffee supplier, the owner of a shabby little shop down by the docks, was a aficionado like myself and hand-picked the plantations where he bought his coffee beans. He had supplied me with 12 pounds of excellent Santos and 6 pounds of the best mocha I'd ever tasted. Better still, he had given me 2 airtight containers of Arabica seeds. I suspected he had acquired those by shady means, but I didn't care. When we arrived, I would be able to start my own coffee plantation. The scouting probe had sent back detailed maps and extensive exploration data, and I'd already picked out the perfect spot, high up in the hills near to the colony site, on a slope of ideal Terra Roja soil. I would be the first and only coffee farmer on the first extraterrestrial colony. I was looking forward to it. I retrieved the espresso machine and its bag from my other cabinet and shoved off again, a similar smudge on the cabinet door, on a trajectory perpendicular to the previous one, ending up on what Richard called the ceiling of the control room, a stupid name in zero gravity, but he insisted on it. I pressed the access button, and the circular door into the head slid open. With one practiced movement, I contorted myself into the small cubicle with my burdens and started to set up my little coffee brewery. Like all the previous times, I wondered what had possessed the engineers to install a standard power socket into the control room head and none in the living quarters. My espresso machine required both a power source and gravity. When I'd applied for espresso privileges, I'd assumed that there would be a socket by my bunk so I would be able to enjoy my morning cup in my own room. It was only after we left the Earth's gravity well and hooked into the hyperstratum that our routine settled down enough for me to have my morning espresso. Only then did I discover that I couldn't. The living quarters were equipped with specialized sockets for the lightweight equipment developed for the trip. The only standard power sockets I could find were in the control room, where zero gravity prevented me from using the espresso machine. Richard had come to the rescue, though I'm pretty sure he regrets it now. "John!" he'd shouted. I'd swiveled in the pilot's seat and looked up at him where he floated by the round door. He wore a triumphant smirk, and I started smiling in anticipation of the joke he would deliver. "Yeah? Guess where your power socket is?" I'd shaken my head in disbelief. "Yep," he said, thumbing over his shoulder. "In the head?" "In the head." We both laughed then, long and hard, shaking our heads in amused disbelief. This was back in the days when we could still laugh together, before he lost it. I placed the machine on the little shelf and plugged it in. It floated up an inch and a half before the resilience of the power cord stopped it. Settling down on the toilet bowl lid, I sealed the door and hit the spin control switch. A deep hum started to my left, increasing slowly in volume and pitch. The transmission engaged, and with a small jerk, the toilet cubicle started spinning. Back on Earth, I used to take endless baths, soak for hours, replenishing the cooling water from the hot tap half a dozen times. When it was finally time to get out of the bath, I would pull out the plug and stay in just to get the most out of the warm water. It is an incredibly peaceful feeling to have your body settle slowly on the bottom of the tub as the water level drops. Having gravity return as the centrifugal head spins up is almost exactly the same feeling. I felt the bowl lid press harder and harder into my bottom. My arms slowly sank, and my neck muscles engaged to keep my head from lolling forward. The espresso machine settled on the shelf. Switching it on, I poured the water into it and set about grinding my measure of coffee beans as the machine heated up. 10 minutes later, as I was about to sip my fresh cup of espresso, the PA speaker in the head hummed to life. Right on schedule. Richard is nothing if not predictable. "John, I know you're in there. I'm sick of going through this every morning." "You and me both," I thought, and inhaled the delicious coffee fumes. "John, you don't need to take half an hour in there for a cup of coffee. Come on, I need to use the toilet." I took my first sip of the day. The black liquid, just short of scalding, rolled around my mouth, the sweet, strong taste of the Santos, perfectly balanced by the distinctive, winey flavor of the mocha. I savored the taste for a few seconds and swallowed, feeling the heat travel down my esophagus and into my stomach. The subtle aftertaste tingled on my tongue. Perfect. "John, don't make me do an override!" Eyes closed, I balanced the coffee cup in one hand and switched off the PA with the other. I was the engineer on the ship. Richard couldn't override the controls to save his life. As we made our way out of the solar system after departure, it had seemed that the psych profile team had done a good job. Richard and I worked together very well at first, and got along decently. I never had the illusion we would become anything like close friends, but the cooperation went amicably enough, and during the first few weeks, I don't remember a single sour note between us. After all, we were both professionals, with a wealth of experience in our respective careers, me as an electronics engineer, Richard as a physicist. We had gone through the training program together, both excelling, though I'd paced myself and let Richard outscore me on almost every subject. Even then, he seemed to need the confidence boost it must have provided him. For the colony project, they had chosen not to employ professional astronauts because they wanted people who could also fulfill a civilian role once the colony was established. Therefore, they decided to work with the most suitable among the colony group, putting us through months and months of extremely intensive training. For my part, I was confident I could run the ship in my dreams, and anyway, most of it was fully automated. Once we had passed the asteroid belt, our duties had been reduced to the daily verification protocols and maintenance schedules. Even those were almost perfunctory. The logs we maintained were mostly columns and columns of ASN against dates and times. All systems nominal. But by the time we topped out at 32 lights, ASN applied only to the ship. not to us. Discarding the used coffee grounds into the toilet bowl, I cleaned and dried the machine and my cup with a few bits of toilet paper and flushed. Then I hit spin control, and the whine of the spin engine wound down into the lower registers as I felt my weight lift. I packed the espresso machine back into its bag as the toilet cubicle slowed to a halt. Immediately, the door shushed open, and Richard's angry face appeared. "God damn it, John! What do you think you're doing switching off the PA? Get out of there now!" He grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled, hard, sending me on an uncontrolled spin across the control room. I managed to twist around, so I hit the pilot seat with my back, thus protecting the espresso machine against sudden impact. It hit me in the stomach, winding me and causing my back to slam into the seat a second time. Cursing Richard, I propelled myself across the control room to store my stuff. 5 minutes later, as I was going through a routine check of the cryo monitors, Richard emerged from the head and made his way to the nav seat. Strapping himself in, he ran some checks without much conviction, then cleared his throat.
Listen, John, we need to talk about this.
I pretended to ignore him, continuing my cryo check.
I'm sorry I blew up, and I shouldn't have pulled you out like that. I apologize.
Still cycling through the monitoring equipment, I glanced at him from the corner of my eye. He looked honestly sorry, but I was determined to make him suffer for his behavior.
The thing is, John, I am worried about you.
Worried? I blurted. I didn't mean to say anything, but his statement was too unexpected, too tangential. I half turned towards him.
You are aware, I hope, that you breached protocol by switching off the PA system?
He was right, and it shook me up a bit that I hadn't realized it. I was not about to let him know that, though.
Of course I was aware of that. What's the big deal? You were getting on my nerves, Richard. My morning coffee is important to me.
What's the big deal? He exclaimed. I could tell he was getting worked up.
The big deal is that those protocols are in place for a reason. If we let ourselves slack off...
He stopped, and I could tell he made a mental effort to calm himself down.
But that's not even the point, John. Forget the protocols. Your behavior worries me. This whole thing with the coffee and blocking the head for me and switching off the PA. You've been spending more and more time in there, and your behavior is getting more and more erratic by the week. I'm sorry I have to say this, but we need to get it out in the open. The way things are going now, our command team is unstable, and that could jeopardize the whole expedition. We need to find a solution, work things out. As a team.
You're making too much of it, Richard. I jumped in the moment he stopped talking. It's just a minor disagreement. We are both professionals. You'll just have to learn to compromise on this.
Compromise? Richard burst out. Compromise? Do you have any idea how long you were in there just now?
I shrugged. Long enough to have my coffee. 20 minutes or so?
3 hours, John! You were in there for 3 goddamn hours! I had to abandon control and use the toilet in my quarters to keep from crapping my pants! Do you call that normal behavior, John? Sitting in the toilet for 3 hours with the PA switched off?
In confusion, I flashed a look at the clock on the main monitor. What I saw chilled me. I had to keep myself from blowing up at him. Richard, what are you doing? If switching off the PA system is a breach of protocol, how about changing the system clock? What possessed you to do that? Wide-eyed, Richard opened his mouth as if to speak. His jaw shuddered and his left hand shook in a powerless gesture. Then he muttered,
"Jesus!"
unbuckled and made his way out of the control room. I didn't see him again that day. But the next day, my coffee beans were gone. Our problems had started soon after I got over my spell of space sickness. In our training, we had been warned about the possibility of this ill-named affliction. Space sickness has nothing to do with any physical discomfort. It is simply a state of listlessness, frustration, and even depression brought on by extended periods of space travel. It hit me about 2 weeks into our trip. Of course, I recognized the symptoms immediately, but that didn't help to make it any more endurable. I think it lasted a little over a week, but it was one of the worst weeks of my life.
I dragged myself through my duties and had perfunctory talks with Richard, but other than that, my days were bleak and endless. For most of the time, I just lay on my bunk, stared at the featureless ceiling, and waited for time to pass. I was assailed by doubt and insecurity. Did Richard take me seriously? Did I know what I was doing? Was he laughing at me behind my back? For days, I watched him when he wasn't looking, alert for any sign he was holding out on me. I never saw any, but the paranoid feeling, the distrust, took a long time to abate. Homesickness, too, came to torture me. There was no turning back, now or ever, and I'd left behind everything I knew and everyone I'd loved. Ahead lay light years of empty space, at the end of which was an empty planet that would be the final destination for myself, Richard, and our cargo of 424 colonists. None of us would ever return to Earth. Due to our relativistic speeds, everyone I knew would be dead by the time we arrived. It was a horrible time. In my darkest moments, I considered carefully how I would override the airlock safeties to expel myself into space without a suit. I went over the circuit plans and practiced the rewiring procedures in my head. For 48 terrible hours, suicide seemed a desirable end. Richard looked at me oddly a few times during that period and asked me if anything was wrong. I assured him I was fine. I didn't see any reason to bother him with my problems. Our psych trainer had insisted that space sickness should be discussed with the other, dealt with openly, but I didn't feel the need. Or maybe I didn't want to unburden in front of him. I think I felt some embarrassment about the whole depressing situation. I'd much rather get over it myself than let Richard know I'd fallen apart. And so I did, in the end. I was fine now. I remembered very well how that period of space sickness had affected me, but I was intelligent enough to have self-diagnosed and pulled myself out of it. I was pretty sure that Richard, for all his, "Are you all right?" and "You can talk to me," had no idea how bad it had been. For that matter, I don't believe he could have performed the same feat of self-healing. Where's my coffee? Blocking someone's path and facing them down isn't quite so effective in zero gravity, but I gave it all I had. Richard just frowned. What are you talking about? My coffee? It's gone. Where is it? Richard pushed past me. How the hell should I know? You probably misplaced it somewhere. I grabbed him by the arm without thought. His momentum pulled me along, and we spun head over heels toward our seats, both grunting as we crashed into the backs. I'll ask you again. Don't be stupid, Richard interrupted. Why would I do anything with your coffee? I don't even like the stuff. He clambered over his seat and strapped himself in. I followed his example. Why? I don't know. Why would you reset the system clock? Maybe you're trying to mess with my head. Now tell me where my coffee is. Grabbing his upper arm, I squeezed for emphasis. Jesus, John, get a hold of yourself! He pulled off my hand and shoved it away. Use your brains at least. Of course I didn't change the clock, and you know it. You were in there for 3 hours yesterday. Maybe it's time you asked yourself what's wrong with you. I know I didn't touch your coffee! I had heard enough. I knew how long I'd taken for my morning coffee, and that meant he had changed the clock. And with us the only two people defrosted on board, I could do the math on who had messed with my coffee. I'm warning you, Richard. Two can play that game. I want my coffee back by tomorrow morning, or you'll suffer the consequences. Christ! Richard muttered, and turned to the control panel. But he didn't fool me for a moment. Our shift passed in icy silence, each of us going through our duties mechanically. After the shift, Richard disappeared into the cargo hold, where he usually did his workout. I had a quick meal and went to bed. The lack of coffee had thrown my whole day out of whack, and I was immensely tired. The next morning, I didn't even bother logging onto my console. I turned immediately to my cabinets. But the coffee was nowhere to be found. And when I went into Richard's cabinets, I discovered that he'd stored his collection of interactive 3Ds somewhere else. So much for my plan to get back at him. I was without my coffee, and Richard could still enjoy his utility privileges for his 3Ds, live through his planetary simulations, play his stupid games. It was enough to fly into a rage, but I kept calm. When Richard appeared, I smiled and said nothing, merely went through my routines as he did. I caught him looking at me a few times, but I pretended I didn't notice. Like the day before, Richard disappeared aft directly after our shift. And, like before, I felt exhausted. This time, however, I ignored the passage that led from the central corridor to my room and took the opposite passage. Climbing down and outwards, I found myself at Richard's door. I told him two could play this game. It was my turn now. Getting in was a matter of seconds. I looked around his private space, identical to mine in layout and design, but infinitely messier. Cabinet doors left partially open, empty cups out on shelves, a row of pictures displayed haphazardly instead of a straight line. Through the connecting door to my left, I could see his bedroom, tiny like mine, and noted the sloppy job he'd done making his bed. The whole place made me very uneasy. I resolved to do my business and get out quickly. I went through his cabinets rapidly and systematically, finding clothing, books, some personal effects, food, other things. I made a conscious effort to ignore the disorderly way everything was stored and folded, and suppressed my urge to straighten out everything, refold his clothes, line up his pictures. I took things out of the cabinets only when I absolutely had to, and put them back exactly the way I found them. I came across his 3D's disc collection and spent some time shuffling those and switching them around in the cases. But my coffee was nowhere to be found. Back in my room, I was too tired and listless to do anything but have a heat a meal and go to sleep. I stripped off my outer clothes and hopped onto my bunk, thankful that the engineers had chosen to give the living quarters an axial spin. I'd heard that other ships came equipped with a kind of webbing for sleeping in zero gravity, but we had rotational gravity in our rooms. Going to bed, I could enjoy the feeling of actually laying back on the mattress and feeling the soft... Something pressed into my back. Something small but annoying. I squirmed and changed position, thinking it was a fold in the sheet. But it stayed in place and was impossible to ignore, however small it was. I had to sit up and feel under the sheet, but when I grabbed it, I was already convinced I knew what it was. And what it implied about Richard's state of mind was disturbing. It was a coffee bean.
"Are you trying to drive me insane?"
I shoved the coffee bean into his face as he came into the control room.
"Is this your idea of fun?"
"That's it," Richard replied. "We need to talk, now." He pushed himself past me and sailed to his seat, somersaulting over the back so he landed smoothly in a single movement. I hated it when he showed off like that. I pushed off and took my time climbing in the pilot's seat.
"Sure, let's talk," I said. "Let's talk about your sick games. Why don't you explain this?"
I flicked the coffee bean toward him. It missed his face and bounced off the control panel.
"John, you're out of control. I think you know this on some level, but I cannot wait for you to see for yourself. Too much depends on us. We're responsible for 400 lives besides our own. I can't afford to have you in the engineer's seat like this."
"I'm out of control? Are you joking? Who's the one messing with my head? Who's the one messing with the time, stealing my coffee, and putting beans in my bed?"
"Just shut up, John. Just shut up. Maybe you even believe I'm doing what you say I'm doing. It doesn't matter.
This is your official Protocol 14 notification. I've started the defrosting sequence for Andy. He'll be with us by tomorrow. I'm sorry, John. I have to replace you. You're out of control." Protocol 14. I understood then that Richard was really lost to the expedition. Protocol 14 specified the steps either of us was to follow to replace the other if, quote, apparently incompetent to perform the required duties. It demanded that whoever would be replaced would be officially notified in advance, but this notification could only be given after the defrosting was initiated for the replacement. This meant that Richard, in his delusional state, really meant to replace me. He might even be speaking the truth about defrosting Andy. How had I let it come this far? I unbuckled and got up so hurriedly I shot out of my seat and crashed my head into the overhead display. I heard Richard shout my name, but I ignored him. Sailing across the control room, I entered the spin lock. It took forever for the lock to spin up to axial rotation speed. Finally, the aft door slid open. Before it opened all the way, I pulled myself through and propelled myself hand over hand along the rungs in the central shaft through the living quarters, where the gravity was still negligible. I flew along the rungs, pulling myself along mechanically, without thought, without looking. I crashed headfirst into the bulkhead. Entering the code to access the cargo hold, I hit the door switch and floated into the darkened vault of Cryo Unit 1. Rows upon rows of cryo sarcophagi radiated out from the central axis. A complex system of rungs and bars connected the door I'd just come through to the star-shaped central space of the first layer and spread out like a steel web all the way down to the second bulkhead. I didn't hesitate. I knew exactly where Andy was. I was on my way to verify what Richard had said about the defrosting sequence. Never mind Protocol 14. Maybe he had only imagined initiating the sequence, or maybe he was just threatening me, using the prospect of replacing me to force me to give him what he really wanted, whatever that was. I just needed to see if Andy's sarcophagus was really defrosting. That was all. I worked my way along the bars and rungs until I reached the right layer. Then I oriented myself along Spoke C and climbed outwards toward Unit 6. As I glided past the sarcophagi of the colonists, there was a squeezing in my stomach. Despite the cold in the cargo hold, I was sweating. When I came to Unit 6, I released a relieved sigh. The glass lid of the sarcophagus was still frosted over, and the lights on the control panel indicated an undisturbed cryosleep. Richard had lied. But when I moved my head a little, I saw the name on the sarcophagus. It wasn't Andy. I was in the wrong layer. And when I looked past this unit to the next layer, the sarcophagus there had a clear lid, and the control panel lights blinked in the pattern I knew from cryo training. He was in the last stages of defrosting. In less than 24 hours, Andy would be awake and ready to take over. Richard wanted to replace me. He was in for a surprise. A dream. A dark dream. A dream of being locked in the larder. The door is closed and the lights are out as always, but this time I know it's an endless space, though I can feel shelves all around me. And it's cold, so cold. My throat hurts from the shouting. My fists ache with pounding the door. I know they all left. I know I'll be in here forever. And this time, I know there is someone in here with me. I feel along the shelves for something, anything, my movements becoming more and more frantic. There are bottles and tins and bags, but as I speed along the shelves, I find more and more long and round objects, smooth and icy cold. There's something I need to find, but I don't know what it is, and my despair grows because I feel his approach. He's coming to lock me away. He's coming with his belt. I cannot hide. There is no light. An icy hand clamps my shoulder. I scream soundlessly and spin around, but no one is there. I feel a chill in my neck. My scalp tingles. My arms freeze up. I don't want to turn around, but I'm slowly and involuntarily spinning on my axis. I close my eyes against what I will see. I know it will be Father. But when I finally open them, it's Andy's face I see, frosted over and glassy-eyed. And this time, my screams aren't soundless. I was in my seat the next morning, and all systems were nominal. I didn't even feel like I'd missed my morning coffee. When Richard burst into the control room, I felt calm like never before. "You sick fuck!" he shouted. "What have you done?" "I don't know what you're talking about," I replied without looking around. "You know damn well what I'm talking about! What did you do to Andy?" "Listen, Richard," I said, still looking in front of me. "I'm not about to let you replace me. You're clearly unstable. I reversed the defrosting on his unit. I don't know what you were thinking, initiating it in the first place.
He's dead, you crazy fuck! You killed him! You stopped the process way beyond the point of no return, and you knew it!
Oh, no, I said. That's right. I forgot all about the PNR. Are you sure he's dead? That would be terrible. Richard screamed incoherently, and I heard him kick off from the bulkhead at me. I shoved against the control panel with my feet and swiveled toward him. I had timed it well. The espresso machine swung around on its power cord and smashed into the side of Richard's head. The hypodermic syringe flew from his hand. He spun away, trailing a beautiful, expanding helix of tiny spheres of blood. There is no interface for changing the system clock. Through the porthole, I could keep an eye on Richard as I worked on the security override. His bleeding had mostly stopped, but there was a fine mist of droplets floating in the airlock. He was starting to twitch, and his eyelids began to flutter. I had almost completed the override when he opened his eyes. I abandoned the opened access panel for the moment to watch him. His eyes opened wide when he realized where he was, and wider still when he noticed he had no suit on. He looked at the porthole and saw me stare in at him. He launched himself at me, bouncing off the door. It must have been painful, with his head already pounding from my blow. He recovered from the collision and looked at me again. I saw his lips move, mouth opened wide, so I suppose he was screaming. I had disabled the microphone on his side, however, and he was too frantic for me to read his lips. I pressed the microphone button on my side. "I'm sorry, Richard, but I've come to the conclusion you are a danger to this expedition. I need to think of the welfare of the colonists. I cannot let you back into the ship." Releasing the button, I went back to the access panel and made the final connections. Then I returned to the porthole. Richard was hunched over the side of the airlock, working the access panel on his side with his bare fingers. I knew he would never get it open. It looked like he had already torn one of his nails. New droplets of blood joined the fine pink mist. I pulled the handle that opened the outer door. Richard shot out on a fountain of air that formed ice crystals around him as he cartwheeled away from the ship. I pushed the handle back to its original position, and the door swung silently shut. I'm tired now, so very tired. I sit in the small chair in my room and stare at my bunk. I don't know how long I've been awake now. Richard's departure seems very far away. I really want to go to sleep, but I can't. I stare at my bunk. The top sheet and blanket are folded down, and I can see the bottom sheet. I can see a tiny bump. I can almost convince myself that it's just a fold. I can almost convince myself that I can get up and pull the edge of the sheet, and it will smooth out. I could sure use some coffee. And that was our story. I had fun reading this. But it's one of those cases where I couldn't help thinking about the character as I narrated, and found myself identifying with him a bit more than I wanted. Here's a bit more in the Too Much Steve category for you. For the last several months, and the past few weeks in particular, I've been dealing with significant anxiety and depression. Anyone notice that Escape Pod's been going up a bit later every week? This isn't the time or place to go into the different stress points or my bad moments. But the insidious thing about mental illness is that it creates barriers to getting help. John's biggest problem in this story wasn't that he was psychotic, though that's pretty high on the list. His flaw was hubris. That first bout of space sickness, knowing he had problems and deciding he'd deal with them himself instead of telling anyone. I know how that feels. I'm feeling no urge to throw people out of airlocks. My negativity is more inward. But my particular issues make it very difficult to accept weakness in myself, and that makes it hard to ask for help in the things I need to do. I don't want to admit that I can't do it all myself. You can guess how hard it is to say that in this outro. Still, no one's an island. I have responsibilities to people, and when it escalates to crisis, which it has a few times now, I have to choose. Fail at everything, or start reaching out. And I'm too proud to fail at everything. I am getting psychiatric care. I'm starting to form the opinion that maybe everybody should try therapy. And I also hold it as one of my core values that I don't hold anything from Anna. The worse I feel, the more I make it a point to tell her. I'm not asking for sympathy, but if you feel you have to say something, don't tell me. Tell Anna she's amazing for putting up with me. Anyway, the point here isn't woe is me. It's a suggestion to anyone else who feels like they're dealing with too much. We're all smart people. You may be good at self-assessment, but not good at self-strategy. If you feel like you're too depressed, or too alone, or too proud to say anything to anyone else, take that as your willpower challenge. Don't prove how strong or how weak you are by keeping it in. Prove it by not keeping it in. Talk to someone. It's hard. I know it is. Do it anyway. See if it helps. End of After School Special. Let's hit feedback for Escape Pod 176, How the World Became Quiet, a Post-Human Creation Myth. This was Rachel Swirsky's surreal future history about the transformation of mankind through various apocalypses. We had unanimous acclaim for Frank Key's reading of this story. Scatterbrain said, "Ah, Frank Key, you have returned. If I ever write something bleak and cynical that needs an audio release, I'll know where to look." The story reactions were mixed. Some felt it was dry and textbooky, as Norm said, or as Steph pointed out, lacking in characters. There was nobody to latch on to and identify with. Others took issue with the plot. Evo Shandor said it felt a little too heavy-handed in the humans are evil theme. Other people loved it for its far-out scope and concepts and imagery. Raving Lunatic said the brilliance of the story inspired him to read Stapledon's Last and First Men. A thoughtful defense of the piece came from Thermonuclear Penguin, who implored people to view it, as the title suggested, as a myth, with the style and purpose that being a myth implies. The quote of the week comes from Itans, who took issue with the idea that our humanness makes us environmentally destructive. He said, "I tend to think the opposite. We get in trouble when we try to behave like we're just another species. What will save us, if we are to be saved, is using our intelligence to comprehend our power and grasp the implications of our actions. That implies that we accept the role as gardeners or tenders of the planet that our gifts thrust upon us." Escape Pod is neither a gardener nor a tender of the planet, but it is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and it's distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. All other rights are reserved by our authors. If you like this week's story, please tell a friend or blog about us, and if you can, please consider donating via the PayPal link on our site, escapepod.org. Also check out our horror podcast, Pseudopod, at pseudopod.org, and our fantasy podcast, Podcastle, at podcastle.org. Our music is by permission of Daikaiju. You can hear more from them at daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. Our closing quotation comes from 18th century French cartographer, hydrographer, and ship artist Joseph Roux, who spent a lot of time at sea. He said, quote, "Solitude vivifies. Isolation kills." We'll see you next week. Until then, have fun.